I'm not going to give you his name.
I didn't ask for it. For the first time, she looked disappointed in him.
In your way,
she said, you did. And she closed the door in his face. Chapter 58 Daniel Weaver was no longer answering calls from his toy phone. He had made this decision after seeing the story about the dead lady on one of the news shows Grandpa Owen liked to watch. Except Daniel felt that lately his grandpa wasn't much enjoying the news shows, which made Daniel wonder why he continued to monitor them so intently. But the toy phone kept ringing. It didn't ring while his mom or Grandpa Owen were nearby, or not since the morning of the dental appointment, when his grandpa had remarked on the noise. It was as though the lady who called herself Karis didn't want to draw that kind of attention. It was Daniel with whom she wished to communicate, not anyone else. And Daniel didn't want to talk to dead people. Daniel had no proof that Karis and the woman in the woods were one and the same. He just knew it to be so, the same way you knew the voice coming out of the ventriloquist dummy was really just that of the man or woman holding it, no matter how still the person's lips stayed. But he wanted Karis to go away. He didn't know why she'd chosen him. He didn't understand why she claimed to have been waiting so long to speak to him. He wasn't important. He was just a boy. And talking to Karis wasn't like talking to an ordinary adult. It was more like talking to Jordan Ansell, the eldest son of Mr. Floyd Ansell, who owned the laundry in town. Something bad had happened to Jordan Ansell while he was in his mom's tummy. And now one eye was smaller than the other, and he couldn't use his withered left arm to lift stuff. Jordan Ansell was all grown up, but he still lived at home with his parents and got paid to iron laundry. Jordan Ansell would ask a question and seem to listen to the answer, but the next thing that came out of Jordan Ansell's mouth would be completely unconnected to what was said before. So a conversation that might have started with Jordan Ansell commenting on the weather would quickly jump from rain to stones to dog hair and eventually finish up with shoes, Jordan Ansell having a particular fascination with what folks did or did not wear on their feet. Jordan Ansell didn't really listen to what anyone said. He heard, but he didn't listen. Karis was like that. Karis would ask a question and say, "Yes, yes, yes," as the answer came, and sound as though she were fascinated by what she was hearing. But her tone never varied, and even Daniel recognized that not everything he said was interesting. Then, once Karis had exhausted her store of yes, 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 she would cut to the chase, like Jordan Ansell focusing on sneakers and cowboy boots, and ask Daniel,
"When will you visit me? When will you come?"
The first time she said this, Daniel asked her where she lived, and Karis giggled as though Daniel had accidentally made a joke, but one only she could understand.
"In the woods." "Where? In a house?" "Not a house."
That laugh again, it made Daniel's scalp itch.
"Then where?" "Among the trees." "Like a witch?" "Maybe a good witch." "How will I find you?" "Start walking and I'll find you." "But where?"
"North."
"Which way is north?"
"You wait till the sun starts to go down, and then you keep it to your left."
"I can't do that."
"Why?"
"Because the woods are dangerous."
"I'll protect you."
"Why can't you just come here?"
"I like the woods."
"You'll like them too.
I can show you the secret places. And then we'll sleep."
Karis kept asking him to go into the woods, and sometimes she'd get mad at Daniel for not understanding why it was so important that he should. She'd begin to talk faster, so fast that Daniel couldn't pick up all the words because they flowed into one another until at last they became just a stream of noise that turned to static before exploding into silence. And when Karis called back again, an hour later, a day later, it would be as if their previous conversation had never occurred, and they would start the dialogue afresh.
When will you visit me? When will you come?
But that was before Daniel realized who Karis was. Now Daniel really didn't want to join Karis in her secret places, and he didn't wish to find out where she slept. Because when he tried to imagine it, he saw worms and bugs, and felt cold, damp earth around him. He knew he should tell someone, his mom, his grandpa, but Karis had made it clear that he wasn't to do this. She was his friend, not theirs. If he told, they'd be angry with him, and she would be angry with him, too. That was when her voice would change, and it made Daniel feel very afraid, because he understood that deep down, Karis was always angry. Sad, but mostly angry. But all this had to stop. Daniel was afraid to sleep. He saw the phone in his dreams, and its ringing woke him, even when it wasn't making any sound at all. The stupid smile under the dial gave him the creeps, and the little black eyes that moved in their plastic sockets reminded him of a dying dog he and his grandpa had found by the side of the road a few months back. The dog had been run over by a car. Its skull was all messed up, its fur torn and bloodied, and its eyes were rolling in its head. Grandpa Owen told Daniel to go stand behind a tree while he went to find a big stone. And the dog hadn't made a sound. Not even at the end. Daniel knew he had to get rid of the phone, but he was afraid to put it in the trash because his mom and grandpa were compulsive sorters, and if they found the phone, Daniel would have to explain why he was throwing it away instead of putting it in the box for the charity store. Daniel didn't think that would be a good idea. He didn't want some other kid getting calls from Karis. Neither could he burn the phone, because matches alone wouldn't do the trick, even if he could find a way to get to them. So Daniel decided to bury it. He waited until his mom was at work and his grandpa was napping. Grandpa Owen usually nodded off between 4 and 5 in order to recharge his batteries before Rob Caldwell, and later Lester Holt came on WCSH. Grandpa Owen said Rob Caldwell looked trustworthy, which was why he liked watching him co-anchor News Center. Grandpa Owen said Lester Holt also looked trustworthy, but Rob Caldwell was local, and Grandpa Owen said it was more important to be able to trust the local guy. Daniel wasn't sure why this was, unless Grandpa Owen was planning to leave Rob Caldwell with the keys to his truck or ask him to look after his wallet. So while Grandpa Owen snored in an armchair, and Wilona was turning down a wedding proposal on Good Times, Daniel went to the tree line at the end of the yard shared by the two properties and dug a hole using a small trowel that he'd removed from the woodshed for this purpose. The ground was harder than Daniel had anticipated, so the hole took a while to dig, and his hands and clothes got messy, but eventually he had a hollow before him that would take the phone. Daniel would have preferred if the hole were deeper. In an ideal world, the hole would have gone halfway to China, but he was afraid Grandpa Owen might wake up and start wondering where he was, so he dropped the phone in the hole and commenced covering it up. He kept his face turned away at first, because those plastic eyes were looking up at him like those of some living creature, and they made him feel bad. But eventually, he could no longer see them, and finally, he could no longer see the phone either. He tramped the dirt down so it was level with the rest of the ground. He thought it still looked a little different, but not so much that anyone would really notice, not unless they searched really hard. Grandpa Owen was just beginning to stir when Daniel returned to the house, giving him enough time to get to the bathroom and clean the dirt from his hands and under his fingernails. The knees of his jeans were filthy, and he wished he'd had the foresight to bring a piece of cardboard or an old towel on which to kneel, but it was too late now. He stripped off the jeans, stuck them at the bottom of a pile of laundry, and changed into a new pair. They weren't the same color, but Grandpa Owen would never notice the difference. When all this was done, Daniel went to the kitchen and stared out over the yard to the spot where the phone was now buried. Even if it rang underground, he wouldn't be able to hear it. No one would. He hoped this might make Karis give up. Maybe she'd go back to where she came from, wherever that might be. He'd seen the footage of the body being carried away from the woods on a stretcher. It had seemed very small. Daniel wondered if Karis had been little in real life, or if death had just made her so. Perhaps only bones had been left by the time she was found. If so, how was she speaking to him? Skeletons didn't talk, except in cartoons. Daniel had heard his mom and Grandpa Owen say that the dead lady had been taken to a mortuary. When Daniel asked what that was, his mom told him it was a place where dead people were kept before it came time to bury them. Although she seemed annoyed that he'd asked, or just annoyed he'd overheard them speaking about the woman to begin with, Daniel wasn't sure which. Did they have phones in mortuaries? Daniel guessed so. Was that how Karis was calling him? Did she creep out of her drawer at night? Because that was where they kept the bodies, in drawers, like Grandpa Owen's business files. Bare bones clacking on the floor, and hide under a desk so she could call Daniel. But Karis couldn't be in a drawer, because she claimed to live in the woods. And sometimes Daniel could hear the sound of branches rustling in the background. In the end, he decided it was probably best not to think too hard on such matters. Karis was a ghost, that was all, and ghosts weren't like people. They probably had their own way of doing things. He just wanted Karis to do those things someplace else, and with someone else. Perhaps they just needed to bury her again. It could be that Karis didn't like being locked away in a drawer, although being buried under dirt seemed worse to Daniel. And being burned, like some dead folks were, sounded worse still. He heard Grandpa Owen calling, asking if he was okay.
Yes,
he said. Yes, he hoped. Chapter 59. Ivan Giller knew nothing of atlases or buried gods. He did not go to church, and believed that death marked the snuffing out of all consciousness. He disliked violence, and consequently did not own a gun, even though he regularly dealt with violent men. He was a buyer and seller, mostly of information. He was a source and a channel, and was very good at what he did. Giller's introduction to the lawyer Quayle had been facilitated through a series of trusted cutouts, with the promise of a bonus well above the norm if he could help the Englishman successfully tie up his affairs, and thus, it was made clear, encourage his speedy departure from the continental United States. Giller was aware that the commission ultimately came from the same people who paid him to watch Parker, although he had never met any of them face to face, and didn't care to. From what Giller had gleaned of them, a little knowledge certainly qualified as dangerous, and a lot might prove fatal. Initially, it had seemed like a simple assistance job, but now Giller was regretting ever becoming involved in it. First of all, there was the lawyer himself. Giller had met plenty of attorneys in his time, and could count on his thumbs the number he trusted, but Quayle resembled a being created from the distilled essence of all that was disreputable about the legal profession. Giller suspected that when Quayle died, every bone in his body would be revealed as slightly bent. And then it was Moores, Quayle's shadow, who dressed like a schoolmarm and smelled like a whorehouse mattress. Giller couldn't recall ever encountering a more malformed woman, with her graveyard pallor, her too shiny skin, her too small teeth, her fingers like the legs of a spider crab, and a voice that had the same impact upon the ear as an abrading instrument. She made Giller want to hide in a cellar. Then there was Parker. Giller's days of monitoring him from a discreet distance had come to an end. Parker now knew what Giller looked like, and was probably already endeavoring to put a name other than Smith to the face. No good could come from having Parker take an interest in the fact of Giller's existence. Finally, and most pressingly, there was the not-too-small matter of the mutilated child. Giller could conceive of it in no other way, glimpsed the previous evening. He might have managed to convince himself he had imagined it, or conjured it from his subconscious as a prelude to a fever. Except he knew Parker had seen it, too. Giller understood on some primal level that its presence must somehow be linked to Quayle and Moore's. But he wasn't about to invite either of them to clarify the relationship. He was simply aware of having wandered into a situation that presaged no good for anyone, least of all Ivan Giller, and it would be a very good idea for him to extricate himself from it as quickly and efficiently as possible. With that in mind, Giller made a call to his contact. He, who had finally put Giller in touch with Quayle, seeking to void what was, in essence, no more than a gentleman's agreement. Absent the gentleman. This particular contact was an elderly dealer in rare coins and stamps, although he was said to have secured a comfortable old age by selling very specialized pornography, back in the good old days before the Internet drained much of the profit from distributing sexual images on paper and film. The dealer got back to him within the hour, making it clear that Giller's involvement with Quayle could not be undone. And not only Giller's continued good health, but the good health of a number of people up the line, including the dealer himself, were dependent on his remaining in Quayle's good graces. So Giller was screwed, and no mistake. This left only Plan B. Get Quayle what he wanted, collect the bonus, and consider not answering the phone again for a very long time. To this end, Giller began calling in a lot of favors. The principal backer was working on the restoration of a Georgian walnut bureau dating from about 1740. It was in miserable condition when he first acquired it, although that was part of the challenge for him, and the pleasure. The feet were beyond salvation, and the handles were incongruous Victorian replacements. But the boxwood inlay and ebony stringing remained intact, and it had somehow retained its original leather writing surface, along with the 18th-century lock and key for the desk itself. He had been laboring over the piece for almost a year now, and had recently sourced appropriate handles from a similar bureau with mortal injuries. His bureau, by contrast, would soon be suitable for resale. Through an agent, of course, and without the principal backer's own name ever being mentioned in connection with it. He expected it to make about $2,000 at auction. Even if this return wouldn't even begin to compensate him for his efforts. Money wasn't the object, though. It was the act of bringing something back almost from the dead. It was about returning some beauty to the world. This was why he was so careful to conceal his involvement in the restoration. He was surrounded by those who regarded this world as forfeit, and would therefore consider even the most minor of aesthetic improvements to it as indicative of a deeper malaise, one worthy of further investigation. Beside him, his cell phone began to ring. He wiped the oil from his hands before picking up. "Yes?"
"It's Quayle," said a woman's voice.
Her name was Erin, and she took care of the minutiae of the backer's affairs. "What now?" A pause.
"He wants to meet with you."
The principal backer had a certain profile and a circle of acquaintances, both professional and personal, that knew nothing of his baser vocation. He remained careful to meet in conclave even with his fellow backers only once or twice a year, and had never yet encountered Quayle in person. In theory, Quayle did not know the principal backer's true identity. But in practice...
"I suppose declining the invitation is not an option," he said.
"It's always an option. Whether it's advisable is another question,"
The principal backer considered the situation. Perhaps it was time to call in his marker in return for the assistance Quayle had already received. He would have Aaron pass on the necessary details. Quayle wouldn't refuse. He wanted the book too badly.
Did he nominate a venue?
He left the decision to you. What about your club?
The principal backer's Boston club was both exclusive and discreet. It was regularly swept for listening devices of all kinds, and the windows had been treated with signal defense film to block Wi-Fi transmissions and thwart the use of laser microphones to pick up voice data. It was a safe haven for those concerned about business competitors, the U.S. government, or any number of law enforcement agencies eavesdropping on their affairs, which was why it was able to command membership fees of breathtaking expense.
Why not? I'll tell them to fumigate it after he leaves.
That may not be the best frame of mind in which to approach the engagement.
Thank you for your concern, said the principal backer. Now make the arrangements. And Aaron?
Yes?
Keep your distance from him.
He only has this number.
Then after you've informed him of the time and place of the meeting, and a small favor I plan to ask of him, change your phone. This was an unusual level of precaution, even by the standards of the backers. The phone was new. Aaron had only recently circulated its number to the others.
Would you like me to provide additional protection for you?
She asked.
There is no protection, said the principal backer. Not from Quayle.
Chapter 60 Parker called Mela Lombardi from his car, but both the cell and home numbers went straight to voicemail. He guessed that Molly Bowe would probably have tried to contact Lombardi to let her know that she'd shared Lombardi's details with him, which might be for the best. If Lombardi was involved in sheltering desperate women from violent men, it was possible her view of the male sex could qualify as somewhat jaded. Even in her present mood, Bowe would be able to smooth the way. Parker was traveling against the traffic for most of his journey, and only got snarled up when he reached the outskirts of Portland. He thought about leaving Lombardi until the following morning, as it was now dark, and he didn't want to disturb an elderly woman who might be about to settle down with a meal in front of her TV. Then he remembered that this was an elderly woman who was involved in an abuse victim's equivalent of the Underground Railroad, and was therefore probably familiar with being roused from her chair at inconvenient moments. He tried Lombardi's numbers for the fourth time, with the same result, before deciding to call Molly Bowe as he crossed the Casco Bay Bridge to South Portland. There was always the chance that Bowe had managed to get hold of Lombardi, who was now battening the hatches against him. If so, she was underestimating his persistence. Bowe sounded harried when she came to the phone, but it might have been a hangover from their earlier conversation. "One quick question," said Parker. "Have you been in touch with Mela Lombardi since we spoke?"
"No. I mean, I tried, but I haven't been able to make contact."
"I haven't either."
"Where are you?"
"South Portland. I'm on my way to Lombardi's now."
"She usually answers her phone. It's rarely off, for obvious reasons."
"If she was planning to leave town, who would she inform?" A pause.
"I can't give you any more names. I shouldn't have given you Mela's."
"Fine, I understand." And Parker did, although he wished he didn't. "I'll take a look at the house and see what's happening. But if I get back to you, be ready to make some calls. Just don't go alarming anyone yet." Molly agreed. She didn't have a whole lot of choice, and didn't like not having a whole lot of choice. She was still letting Parker know this when he hung up, but by that point, he'd gotten the message. The Lombardi house on Orchard Road was dark when Parker arrived, and he saw no car in the drive. He rang the doorbell twice, just in case Lombardi was sleeping, before making a circuit of the property. All the doors and windows were locked, and nothing appeared to be disturbed when he shone his pocket flashlight inside. He was about to call Molly Bowe again, when a neighbor began hovering in a yard across the street. Parker headed over and showed the woman his ID. She was in her 40s, but with the kind of long, prematurely gray hair that suggested either massive self-confidence or the blessed state of not giving a rat's ass. Judging by her clothes, which were expensively casual, Parker opted for the former. But he still felt the hair wasn't doing her any favors. He guessed she might have been described as handsome, but not by him. Cary Grant was handsome. Lots of men were. But generally speaking, Parker believed it was better for women to avoid the label. The neighbor told him her name was Dakota, which figured, and she'd been living on Orchard for 10 years now. She knew Mela Lombardi well. They worked together at various community organizations. Dakota asked if Parker was concerned about Mela, and he answered that he wasn't as yet, but remained anxious to speak with her.
"I haven't seen her for a few days," said Dakota.
"Is that unusual?" Dakota frowned and scrunched up her nose. It made her look younger than she was, that damn gray hair apart.
"You know, it kinda is. She'd usually let me know if she was going away, just so I could keep an eye on her place. It's not like we have a lot of burglaries around here, but it pays to be careful."
It turned out that Mela Lombardi had a niece named Jeanette Howard, who lived a couple of blocks away on Arlington Lane. So Parker drove over there, parked outside the house, and rang the bell. The door was answered by a young woman who might have been taken for about 15, were it not for the three young kids, two boys and a girl, alternately tugging at her arms and calling her mommy, while simultaneously peering with varying degrees of interest at the visitor on their doorstep. "Jeanette Howard?"
"Yes."
For the second time in 30 minutes, Parker identified himself and indicated that he was seeking to speak with Mela Lombardi.
"My aunt lives just over on Orchard," said Howard. "She should be home right now."
"She isn't. I was wondering if she'd given any indication that she might be about to leave for somewhere."
"Mela never goes away. She doesn't approve of vacations."
"Would she tell you if she intended to take a trip?"
"Maybe, if she was going to be out of town for a while. But like I said, she's a homebody."
She hushed her children, and silence descended for a moment or two.
"Should I call the police?"
Parker said it was her decision, but if she wanted to check the house first, he'd be happy to accompany her.
"I don't have anyone to look after the kids. My husband is working nights this week."
Parker could see she was starting to worry now. "What about the woman who lives across the road, Dakota?" he said. "Would it be okay if she entered the house with me?" Howard was happy enough to go along with Parker's suggestion, as long as either Dakota or Parker called her as soon as they'd taken a look inside. So Parker returned to Orchard Road, where Dakota was waiting in Lombardi's yard, Jeanette Howard having called her in the interim to let her know that Parker had permission to enter the house. He wasn't concerned as yet about contaminating a possible crime scene. Lombardi might well have gone away for a day or two. But equally, she could have fallen or been taken ill. Neither was he trespassing on private property, as he had the niece's consent to enter. He pulled on a pair of gloves, just in case, and used Dakota's key to open the front door. The alarm didn't sound. That was the first unusual thing Dakota noticed.
"Mela always sets the alarm when she leaves," she said. "Shit."
Dakota called Mela's name, but there was no reply. Parker told her to stay by the door while he searched the house and not to touch anything. It didn't take long to establish that it was empty. The beds were made, and the kitchen and bathroom were spotless. The bookshelves contained a lot of poetry and alternative lifestyle books, along with some feminist writing and various semi-mystical works. Carlos Castaneda, Robert Persig, Khalil Gibran. But not much fiction. More books of a similar stripe stood piled on a packing chest that functioned as a coffee table in the living-come-dining room, along with the most recent copy of the Maine Sunday Telegram folded open to a puzzle page. Beside the newspaper were a pen and a pair of bifocals. Dakota had not moved from her post by the door, but Parker could see her from where he stood, and she him. Her hands were deep in the pockets of her jeans, and she was hunched with anxiety. "Does her home always look this tidy?" he asked.
"Mail is that kind of person."
Parker looked at the spectacles again. Given her age, it wasn't a surprise that Lombardi might require bifocals, and it indicated she wore spectacles when she drove. "I don't suppose you'd know if Mela keeps a spare pair in her car for driving," he asked.
"I'm sorry, I don't. I guess, now that you mention it, she does wear them to drive. But I couldn't say if she has a pair just for the car."
Parker went back outside and checked the mailbox. It contained some junk mail, but nothing more. He returned to the house and went through it again, this time examining each room more closely. He wasn't any wiser by the end of the process. Finally, he tried the answering machine on the home phone and listened to the voice messages. He heard two from Molly Bow and a few hang-ups, which were his own earlier attempts to contact Lombardi, but that was all. Dakota's cell phone rang. She looked at the screen.
"It's her niece,"
she said. "You'd better answer it."
"What should I say?"
"Tell her that her aunt's not here, and I'll come by to talk with her as soon as I can." Dakota did as Parker asked while he stood between the dining table and the kitchen arch, trying to find something, anything, that might give him cause for anxiety. But he didn't know Mela Lombardi, and so was unfamiliar with her ways. He could only take Dakota's word that Lombardi maintained a pristine household, and he was wary about raising the alarm over nothing. Dakota claimed that she hadn't seen Lombardi for a few days. But how often did such a period of time go by without one neighbor seeing another? It was hardly shocking. Likewise, the fact that Lombardi hadn't informed her niece she was leaving town might just be because she hadn't gone anywhere in particular. It wasn't against the law for an elderly woman to head out for a time without alerting the Army, Navy, and National Guard. The alarm hadn't been set, but maybe Lombardi was in a hurry when she left and forgot to activate it. And yet there was something off, because he could smell it. An odor, faint but unpleasant. It was strongest over by a big armchair that faced the television. Parker knelt, noticing a faint stain on the fabric of the chair and another on the floor. He leaned closer. He sniffed. Someone had thrown up here, and recently. He touched a finger to one of the stains. It came back slightly damp. So, older people were sometimes ill, just like younger ones. It didn't mean much. Except Mela Lombardi kept a very neat home, and struck Parker as the kind of person who would have cleaned up better than this if she'd puked. It wasn't enough to justify hitting the panic button, but it remained odd. There appeared to be nothing more he could do. He thanked Dakota for her help, watched while she locked up, noting that she took the time to set the alarm, and returned to Jeanette Howard's house. He sat at her kitchen table while her kids played computer games and asked how often she spoke to her aunt.
"Well, not every day," said Howard.
She sounded slightly guilty about this. "But you get on with her," said Parker.
"Yes, mostly."
Parker stepped carefully. He didn't want to alienate the young woman. "I don't mean to pry," he said.
"Mela and I differ on certain issues," said Howard.
"What kind of issues?"
She's pretty liberal.
"On?"
"Everything. Gay marriage, abortion, you know, social stuff."
"And you're not?"
"Nobody's as liberal as Mela."
"So how often would the two of you speak?"
"I call her once a week, or a little less than that, to make sure she's doing okay."
Parker realized he was back where he'd started, with no idea if Mela Lombardi was actually missing or not. "Has your aunt been ill lately?"
"Mela?"
Howard laughed.
"She's healthy as a horse. Why?"
"It smelled like someone might have been sick in the house. Not very much, but enough to leave an odor and a couple of stains."
"That's not like Mela. Although I'm not sure she'd even admit if she was feeling unwell. She'll probably still be trying to make out everything's fine when they're putting her in a pine box."
Howard realized what she'd said and looked ashamed.
God,
she said.
Now should I call the police?
She's an elderly woman. It can't hurt. Howard didn't look enthused at the prospect, but then few people ever did.
Mela has a poor opinion of the police,
she said. Why?
She's countercultural. If I call the cops, then she'd better be missing. If she's just left for the movies and dinner, she's going to be seriously pissed when she gets back.
Chapter 61 Daniel Weaver crouched by his bedroom door, listening to his mom and Grandpa Owen arguing. Since they often argued, mostly about small stuff, Daniel had grown used to their raised voices as a kind of background noise to his existence. Both his mother and Grandpa Owen lived their lives with the volume turned up. His mother claimed that a lifetime spent in trucks had made Grandpa Owen deaf to reason, so she had no choice but to shout at him. Grandpa Owen liked to respond that at least he had an excuse. On this occasion, their back and forth had a different tone, which was what had drawn Daniel to eavesdrop. He had already learned that if adults were trying to keep their voices down, there might be something worth hearing.
I did as you said.
It was Grandpa Owen speaking.
I gave you time to think, but this isn't going away. The longer it continues, the less likely we are to get a fair hearing.
They'll take him from me.
Daniel had the strain to pick up his mother's words.
We'll hire a good attorney.
With what? Are lawyers accepting coupons now?
I got a little left in the bank, and there's the rig.
Silence.
You can't sell the rig.
I'm tired. I can't handle the long hauls anymore. There's still money in her. Not as much as I'd like, but some.
Dishes being stored away. The jangle of the silverware drawer.
We should have been honest from the start.
She made us promise not to.
She shouldn't have, said Grandpa Owen. It wasn't fair.
But look what she gave us in return.
A chair being pulled up, a creaking as weight came to rest upon it. His mother, Daniel thought, because Grandpa Owen always groaned when he stood up or sat down.
What we did was wrong, but not very wrong, said Grandpa Owen. They'll see that he's better off with us. The state doesn't want to put kids in foster homes, not if they can avoid it. It costs too damn much.
The sound of his mother crying. Daniel wanted to go to her, but that would have been to reveal his snooping. All he could do was sit and listen. He didn't want anyone to take him from his mom and Grandpa Owen. He'd run away if they tried. If he couldn't run, he'd fight.
I told you, said Grandpa Owen. I'll make the call from a public phone. I'll be careful not to stay on the line for too long. I'll test the waters, see what Caston says, and you and I can discuss it before we go any further.
And if we don't like what he has to say?
Daniel waited for the answer.
We could leave, I guess, and go someplace far from here.
Grandpa Owen sounded like a man being asked to jump over a stream that looked too wide for him.
But?
Well, if we were to strike camp, said Grandpa Owen, we might just be giving ourselves away.
And then they'd find us, wouldn't they? They'd send the detective, Parker. He'd hunt us down. I don't want him coming after us. He scares me.
So, do I make the call?
This time the silence went on for so long that Daniel was convinced he'd somehow missed his mother's reply, until her voice came, very softly,
"Yes, but not yet."
Jesus.
Daniel heard a chair being pushed back, and he was back between the sheets by the time his mother appeared at the bedroom door. He pretended to be asleep as she came to sit on the edge of his bed. She didn't touch him. Didn't try to wake him, but he could hear her breathing and smell her perfume and feel the fierce heat of her love for him. At last she left, and he turned over on his bed as though twisting in his sleep, so he could watch her as the door closed, before she was lost to him. Chapter 62. Parker was sitting in his home office, updating Moxie Caston on what amounted to very little progress at all, when the alarm on his phone was activated, and seconds later, an unmarked car, its dashboard flasher illuminated to identify the driver as a police officer, pulled up outside his door. Parker had already spoken with Molly Bowe, alerting her to the possibility that Mela Lombardi might be missing, and asking her permission to refer the police to her should they come calling. That permission had not been forthcoming as yet.
"I shouldn't have told you about Mela to begin with,"
Molly said.
"If the police get involved, I'll be forced to give them even more names."
"You can't be forced to give them anything at all. And let me remind you that you told me you didn't have that information."
"Then why sick them on me to begin with?"
Parker had to admit there was a kind of logic to the argument, but it was canceled by an equal amount of illogicality. If Lombardi was missing, then Bowe had at least helped to set in motion some kind of investigation into her whereabouts, and thus had done the right thing by revealing Lombardi's name to Parker, whatever her concerns about betraying confidences. But he also had to recognize that, A, Lombardi might not be missing at all, and B, if she were missing, her disappearance might not necessarily be linked to the Piscataquis remains. Lombardi's work with imperiled women could easily have left her exposed to acts of vengeance from a host of aggrieved partners, as Bowe herself could attest from personal experience. Bowe might be sitting on information that could assist the police in finding Lombardi, but she was also putting the squeeze on Parker in an effort to keep her name out of the investigation. Sometimes Parker's vocation made his head hurt. If he retained any doubts about the reason for this police presence, they were dispelled as soon as the car door opened and the plainclothes officer stepped out. Her name was Kez Carroll, Kez being short for Kestrel, which meant she was officially the most exotically named person known to Parker, as well as the tallest woman, topping out at 6'2" in her stocking feet, and she was the Cape Elizabeth PD's sole detective. Parker had enjoyed occasional professional dealings with her, and always found her to be a straight arrow. Carroll was in her late 50s, and could easily have retired years before. But she appeared to find fulfillment in her work, and who was Parker to question that? He opened the front door before Carroll had a chance to ring the bell, and invited her inside for coffee. She took a seat at the kitchen table while he found some cups. A pot was already brewing.
"Sorry for the late visit,"
said Carroll. "I wasn't doing a whole lot anyway. I take it this is about Mela Lombardi?"
"Her niece called, said she'd spoken with you."
"Did she sound worried?"
"More apologetic."
"She and her aunt aren't particularly close."
"She told us. Looks like you might have lit a small fire under her, though."
"It could be nothing."
"With you involved, give me a break."
Parker poured coffee for both of them and put milk and sugar on the table.
"So?"
asked Carol as she added milk.
"What's the deal?"
"The deal is the Jane Doe from Piscataquis. Moxie Caston hired me to find out what I can about her and the missing child. I can't reveal how I know this, but it's possible, just possible, that Lombardi might have had some contact with Jane Doe."
"Go on."
"I've been trying to figure out why a pregnant woman would head to Maine to begin with, never mind end up buried in a shallow grave with the afterbirth. If she had relatives here, they'd have shown themselves by now."
"Unless they were the ones who put her in the ground. They are the child's father."
"But why hide a death in childbirth? It's not a crime. Unless someone can prove willful neglect."
"You know this state. Once you head out to the Willywax, there's no telling why some folks do the things they do. So what brought you to Lombardi?"
"I've been told she operated an unofficial safe house for women fleeing abusive relationships. What if our Jane Doe was running from the father of her child? What if she was desperate? If she didn't want to turn to state services or Planned Parenthood or whatever other organizations might be in a position to offer help, where would she go? Even if Lombardi hadn't met her, she might know of someone else who did.
But wouldn't Lombardi have come forward if she had some knowledge of Jane Doe?
I'd hope to ask Lombardi that myself. She might have felt under pressure to protect this network of safe houses, because my understanding is that Lombardi is just one link in the chain.
Or?
Or Jane Doe made her promise not to tell.
Why?
Because whoever she was running from was so bad that not only was Jane Doe's life at risk, but so was the life of her child, and perhaps the life of anyone who helped her.
That's a hell of a leap to take.
I've taken bigger. Carol tried her coffee and gagged.
This is horrible,
she said. Organic decaf.
What's the point of that?
Makes me feel virtuous.
Well, whatever helps.
Carol didn't push the mug away, instead electing to keep it clasped in her hands, welcoming the warmth, if not the taste. Spring might have arrived, but the nights continued to bear winter's mark.
As for Lombardi, I'm reluctant to issue a silver alert until more time has gone by.
Silver Alert sent notifications about missing seniors to highway signs around the state, asking motorists to be on the lookout.
I did tell the niece that there was nothing to stop her from putting out the word herself on community bulletin boards, Facebook, Twitter, whatever might help,
Carol continued.
And if Lombardi hasn't made contact by morning, I'll look at speeding up procedures. But Howard was adamant that her aunt had shown no signs of dementia. If Lombardi got in her car and drove away, she knew what she was doing and where she was going.
Unless she didn't leave willingly. Parker told Carol about the stains and the smell.
You know, she said, you see a lot of shadows. You ought to ditch decaf, try regular. It might help.
Carol gave the coffee one more try, if only to be sure it was as unsatisfactory as she thought, before pouring away what was left and depositing the cup in the sink.
Do you know Solange Corriveau?
She asked. Only by reputation.
I'm going to have to share with her what you just told me.
I'm speculating. You can see how thin it is.
Thin or not, she's now the lead on Jane Doe, and she'll take whatever she can get. You should expect to hear from her sometime tomorrow, especially if Lombardi is still missing by morning. She'll want to know more about any possible link between Lombardi and Jane Doe.
I don't have a problem with that, but my source might.
Corriveau won't care one way or the other. She drinks a coffee with extra caffeine and eats her meat raw.
Parker thanked Carol and walked her to her car.
How's your daughter?
She asked as she opened the driver's door. Carol had met Sam a couple of times when she came to visit, and once gave her a ride with the siren on. Sam was suitably impressed. She's good.
Vermont, right?
Right.
It's a hike.
It is. Carol reached out and gave his arm a gentle squeeze, a strangely tender, intimate gesture.
You take care,
she said. You too. Parker watched her drive away and felt the loneliness that made his eyes burn.
Chapter 63. Daniel Weaver lay awake for what felt to him like a very long time, musing on all that he'd heard. The earlier conversation, he sensed, was something to do with Karis. Was she the one to whom they'd made the promise? And what kind of promise had they made to her, if it involved him? The answer prowled as a presence on the edge of his consciousness, but he would not or could not allow it into the light. In time, he fell asleep and dreamed confused dreams until he was drawn back to wakefulness by the sound of his mother's alarm clock in the next room, except that when he opened his eyes, the dark was too deep for it yet to be morning, and the sound was coming not from inside the house, but outside. He pushed back the comforter. He climbed from his bed. He walked to the window and pulled back the drapes. There, on the windowsill, smeared with dirt, stood the toy phone. It was ringing. In her bedroom in Vermont, Sam was roused from sleep by the sound of a telephone. It wasn't familiar to her, not like her mother's cell phone or her grandparents or even the landline in the main house that no one seemed to use, but which her grandfather refused to get rid of because he said, "You never know," whatever that might have meant. The ringing of the phone came from far away and had an unpleasant jangling tone. Sam didn't like it. She wished it would stop. She was weary, and it wasn't even close to morning. It appeared to be coming from outside her window. But that couldn't be right, not unless someone was in the garden, and anyone who was had no reason to be. Quietly, Sam got out of bed and padded to the window. She and her mother lived in converted stables adjacent to Sam's grandparents' property, linked to it by a glass-enclosed walkway that doubled as a conservatory. Sam's room was on the second floor, separated from her mother's by a small bathroom. The bedroom window was a mix of stained and clear panes, recently replaced following an incident involving a bird strike earlier in the year. Sam opened the window. The garden beyond was dark, and she could see no signs of movement. But still the sound of the phone came, although it was no clearer for being unimpeded by glass. It might have been coming from underwater, so distorted was it. Sam turned to the figure sitting on the windowsill. Her half-sister Jennifer, her face glistening behind the strands of hair that overhung it, concealing the worst of the damage inflicted on her by the traveling man so many years before. Jennifer, who walked between worlds.
"Why are you here?"
Sam asked. Jennifer reached out and took Sam's hand. Her touch was cold, but not lifeless. Jennifer's body appeared to exist in a state of soft vibration, as though a small electrical charge were constantly being passed through it. And although Sam had no fear of Jennifer, even loved her in her way, she still did not enjoy physical contact with her. It made her feel dizzy and caused her head to ache. But sometimes it was easier for Jennifer to communicate through touch. Jennifer was a creature of emotions and impulses. Jennifer didn't think so much as feel. Now Sam was made to feel, too. The lake by which Jennifer sat, watching the dead pass, keeping vigil, as they were called, to the sea. The approach of Jennifer's mother, or some manifestation of her, leading an unknown woman by the hand. An exchange of words, of concerns, with Jennifer by the water. Then the departure, the two older women returning to the place whence they came, with a pause only for the familiar exchange between Jennifer and her mother.
"How is your father?"
"Alive."
"And will you continue to stay with him?"
"Yes."
"If you choose to leave, you have only to say."
"I won't abandon him."
"Then goodbye."
No kisses, no embraces. But then this was no longer really Jennifer's mother. It retained her form and some of her memories, but one could not emerge unaltered from the sea eternal. To enter it was to be lost, the dissolution gradual but ultimately entire. Each time Jennifer's mother came back, she brought with her less of her old self. In the end, Jennifer knew her mother would no longer be able to recall her at all, or the man she had once called beloved, the father Jennifer and Sam shared. The contact between Sam and Jennifer was briefly broken.
"Who was the woman with her?"
Sam asked.
"Her name is Karis."
"And what does Karis want?"
"For the sad part of her to rest."
Jennifer touched her sister again, this time just brushing the back of her hand with an index finger, and Sam understood why the woman named Karis had come to Jennifer for help. In dying, Karis had gone to the sea. but she had left something of herself behind, a vestige entombed in a hole in the ground, surrounded by high trees and the cries of birds. It was a dangerous entity, filled with fear and anger and hurt, but also with a terrible thwarted love. It had desires. It wanted its offspring close. It sought to take its child and gather him to itself, to hold him amid dirt and roots, and there they would lie together, until in time the child, like this version of his mother, slept in the earth.
Our father is trying to put a name to it.
Not her, Sam noted. It. Whatever remained of Karis was female in appearance alone.
Does our father know about the child? Not yet. You can't let the boy go to it. It will kill him. It won't mean to, but it will. I know.
Only then did Sam notice that she could no longer hear the ringing of the phone. It had stopped. And Jennifer was no longer present. Chapter 64. Daniel didn't want to answer the phone. It wasn't just that he feared to hear the voice on the other end of the line. He had buried the toy, and now someone had dug it up and placed it on his windowsill. No, not someone. Karis had dug up the phone, which meant she wasn't just some disembodied voice speaking to him over a plastic receiver. She could sift through dirt. She could walk beyond the woods. She could hurt him. But he couldn't leave the phone ringing because his mother might hear, and then he'd have to lie, or worse, explain to her why the phone was on the windowsill to begin with. Karis had warned him against telling others of their little talks, and while Daniel was starting to wonder if that was more for her benefit than his, he was aware that the injunction contained within it an unspecified threat, one that now assumed a new potency given the reality of Karis's physical presence in the world. Daniel picked up the phone.
Hello?
He thought that Karis's voice sounded clearer than before. It might have been the rage in it, but Daniel also detected a faint echo, just as he did on those occasions when his mom allowed him to converse with Grandpa Owen over her cell phone when Grandpa Owen was only in the next room. Not one voice, but two. The first, real and speaking from nearby, and the second, transmitted through the instrument in his hand. Just like now, because Karis was close.
I'm very upset with you. How could you do what you did? How could you put the phone in the ground? I'm sorry, said Daniel. Sorry doesn't cut it, mister. Why did you do it? Tell me.
Daniel began to cry.
Crying won't help either. Crying is for babies, and you're not a baby. Why did you bury the phone? I was scared. Scared of what? Of me?
Daniel didn't want to say any more. He didn't want to make Karis angrier than she already was.
I'm waiting for an answer.
What choice did he have?
Yes.
But then suddenly Karis wasn't angry any longer.
Oh, honey, I'm sorry. You mustn't be scared of me. I'd never do anything to hurt you. I love you. You must understand that. I love you so very...
The phone went dead in Daniel's hand. His attention moved to the yard outside, where a girl was standing on the grass, her head inclined slightly away from him so he could not see her face, her gaze seemingly fixed on the woods at the end of the property. Her hair was blonde, and her feet were bare. They gave the illusion of not quite touching the grass beneath. She did not move, but when she spoke, her voice,
smaller and softer than Karis's, but with a tonality that was not entirely dissimilar, came from very near, as though she were in Daniel's bedroom instead of 20 feet away on ground still cold with the memory of winter.